when a student has he is equipped with these famous four means are of liberation, it's possible that he finds the illuminator, the light within himself. And it is possible that he seeks, and in the course of the seeking, he finds sources of illumination. That source of illumination is called light, Guru. The enlightenment is, the light is within, but someone who can direct the attention to that inner light is the Guru. Or the inner light itself is the Guru. Though the Kathopanishad story has been sort of dramatized and made to appear rather exciting, those of us who are familiar with the biography of one of the saints of India who lived recently, Ramana Maharshi, may even entertain the feeling, if not the belief, that the whole story is based upon a psychological trip, an inner journey, not necessarily going from here to a thing called the world of death, and there encountering the God of death. All this may or may not be true, but what is true is that this boy confronted death, and that's what Ramana Maharshi had. As a little boy, he lay down one day and he felt he was dying. And such was the totality of his being that it was not merely a thought but a fact. You and I can also lie down and say, well, I think I have died. You only think you have died. But if the integration had taken place, that is, yoga had taken place, if the whole being had been harmonized already, then the thought becomes the fact. The thought itself becomes a fact. So he lay down and said, thought to himself, I am dead. And it is said that even his body had become stiff and blue. It's also mentioned in that book, Talks with Ramana Maharshi, that he had that kind of experience once or twice again in his life later, of the death experience. The thought had become fact and the body had become turned blue and the breathing had stopped and so on, and then he was looking at the body. He began to ask, who is this that is looking at the body now? He was still young. Quite likely this Nachiketa's experience or the death experience is very much like that. You don't have to go somewhere to look for death. Death is walking around with us all the time. Like the mind, like the heart, and like the hunger and thirst, like all the cells and the various systems, the respiratory system, the circulatory system, the excretory system, the reproductive system, the unproductive system, and the death system also is built into it. It has not been examined properly because it is not possible to examine. Right? When the circulatory system is functioning, the death system is kept in abeyance, and when the death system comes over, the rest of it is cease to function, and so it becomes difficult or impossible to examine the two together. But it is there in the body, just as fire is hidden in wood. till its time comes.
Mm-hmm.
Fire is hidden in every piece of wood. It is not visible now, it is of course not visible now. But when the time comes, the fire becomes visible. When the fire becomes visible, the wood has ceased to be. The wood ceases to be. That's the only problem. That is why these people, the doctors and the nurses, are not able to examine the two together. How does life function and how does death happen? The two together cannot be examined. It's there. Therefore, I don't have to go to a place called the abode of death. The body is the abode of death. And if I want to, I can face it even now, right now. It's possible that death experience itself was the Guru of Nachiketas. One who has this inner experience is still asked by that death experience that Nachiketas had. He still asked Uttishtata Jagrata Prapya Varan Nibodhata. Sure, you had some experience, right? It is the experience of inner light. But it is better to go and have it attested by a superior person, by someone who has also had similar experience. So that in that encounter, again, it is possible that for you to verify your experience, your own experience, and it is possible that there are some confusion in the experience, the reality mixed with illusion. And in that encounter, all that will be sifted and the truth made clearer to you. In order that we may not go away with the impression that in order for self-realization I must go somewhere and get that knowledge from somebody. Once again the Upanishad goes on to say that this truth is not far away from you spatially. This truth is not beyond your reach in the sense of being on the other side of the lake. But it is with that, through that, by the grace of that alone, you are able to look, you are able to breathe and you are able to live. That is there and therefore you are able to see. That is there and therefore you can hear. That is there, therefore you are able to speak. So you reach out to the Guru externally perhaps in order to confirm an inner experience and in order that you may not be led away by the externalization of the Guru himself throws you back upon yourself. And that is called the Upanishad. Upanishad means, one of the meanings is to sit near each other. To sit near each other. That's all. What happens afterwards cannot be defined. There may be mere look. There may be a few words exchanged. There may be the most ridiculous yelling, as the Zen people are supposed to do. But somehow the truth is not communicated. Unless you use the word communicated in the sense of finding the oneness. Where the I dissolves and therefore the you dissolves. When the I has dissolved, you has dissolved too. When both these has dissolved, because they are not two, When both these has dissolved, what exists is the truth. And that is communication. If you want to use it that way, use it. As long as the I remains, there is no communication. I am blocking, I is blocking it. And in that encounter between the disciple and the guru, they find out how best to reach that spot. In order to illustrate it still further, there is another lovely little Upanishad and a story. The Upanishads are full of stories, surprisingly, because people think that it's a tremendously serious adventure and one shouldn't use any illustration, one must be terribly serious. First of all, if you are too serious, you go to sleep. The mind rejects it. And secondly, words themselves being symbols and loaded symbols. Words are not merely symbols, but loaded. Every word has the load of centuries of misinterpretation and misapplication, misuse, so that when a word is used, what you see in that word is maybe quite different from what I see from that word. So sometimes they resort to illustrations and stories. Though the Upanishad does not specifically say so, it suggests that a seeker approaches the guru and asks a question. The first word of the first question happens to be Kena, and therefore they used that as the title of the Upanishad. It's called Kena Upanishad. I am bringing that to your attention because it wasn't born as Kena Upanishad. It's not a sort of thing that was... It was a piece of dialogue which someone else heard and recorded. And eventually it became a sort of beautiful little dialogue. And they didn't even know how to edit it and how to invent a nice catchy title for it. They looked at the dialogue itself, there is one word, the first word, Kena, and they put it up there as the title. So that not to get too hung up on these details. Who wrote this and who recorded this and when was it carbon dated and all that is totally irrelevant. It's the message that is important. Kena eshatam patati preshatam manaha kena prana prathama prayiti yuktaha. The question was obviously asked by a student. It arose in the mind of a student. He says, now, how does the mind work? How does the mind function? This question we never ask ourselves. Even if we ask ourselves, the mind itself provides an answer, which is its own function. I ask, how does the mind function? And the mind provides an answer. That is also a function of the mind. How am I going to arrive at the answer, at the true answer to this question, how does the mind function? If the mind functions in order to provide the answer, it still hasn't answered the question. And so he is intrigued, perplexed. Right? This is a question which you may not be able to find an answer without the help of someone. Whatever form the help might take. He may do nothing at all. He may blink at you. Yeah. Or he may stick his tongue out. It is not necessary for that person, as you will see immediately, for him to answer your question, He may throw a question back at you. But you are puzzled. I see the mind functions and it makes the body function, right? That seems to be fairly clear. I'm sitting here because I thought I should sit here. And when the time is up, I think I should leave this place and I'll leave this place. So thought precedes action. Thought precedes action. But thought is an action, mental action. How can thought precede thought? Not possible. So I come to you with this question. I see that thought precedes physical action and thought precedes verbal action. I also see that thought itself is an action, mental action. What precedes this mental action? How does it, from where does it arise? Who makes the thought arise? That's the question. Kena prana prasama prahiti yuktaha. I see that the eyes are very important. They are preeminent among the organs of the body. If the eyes are not there, I won't be able to see you. I can live without the ears, I can live without the nose, I guess. But the eyes are important. But there is something supremely important, and that is the life breath. I can live without the eyes. I can live without the ears. I can live without the nose. But I cannot live without the life breath, prana. Why is that?